From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dr. Lynn Emowitz of Physicians for Human Rights talks about her travels through Iraq in April and May, assessing the conditions in hospitals, observing the chaos at recently discovered mass graves, and talking with doctors who say they were forced to participate in torture. Also, visiting Uncle Andy Warhol, we talk with artist James Warhola, who has written and illustrated a new children's book about a visit to Uncle Andy's home in 1962, the year he made his first Campbell's soup cans. Warhola says Andy's house was like a giant amusement park. And rock historian Ed Ward talks about the early days of the Velvet Underground when the band was managed by Andy Warhol. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Department of Homeland Security has raised the nation's terror alert level one notch to code orange. The decision came on a day when the White House confirmed that intelligence agencies have been picking up increased message traffic by terrorist groups about a possible attack. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Orange is the second highest level on the five-color terror alert chart. The heightened status comes a week and a day after bombings at a residential complex in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Eight Americans were among those who died in the attack, which Saudi officials say was the work of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda terrorist network. The so-called chatter cited by the Department of Homeland Security is not specific, but its nature creates concern about the possibility of an Al-Qaeda attack against U.S. citizens, either overseas or in this country. The U.S. Embassy and a pair of U.S. consulates in Saudi Arabia have also been closed, though they are slated to reopen on Sunday. The White House press secretary says the status of the terror alert is reviewed day to day. The last time the country was at code orange was prior to the start of the Iraq War. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The House has passed legislation that would speed up logging on 20 million acres of federal forest land that are deemed to be overgrown and vulnerable to wildfires. President Bush welcomed the measure.
For too many years, bureaucratic tangles and bad forest policy have prevented foresters from keeping our woodlands healthy and safe.
Supporters of the measure say it would make it easier for loggers to thin out the forests, removing smaller trees and underbrush that can help fires to spread. Conservation groups said the bill uses the threat of forest fires to roll back environmental protections. Canadian health officials announced today that a cow in Alberta has tested positive for mad cow disease. The cow was slaughtered last January after it appeared to have pneumonia. NPR's Joe Palka has more.
The 8-year-old cow was from a farm in northern Alberta. The remainder of the farm's herd will be destroyed, although mad cow disease typically does not spread from animal to animal. Canadian officials say no part of the animal made it into the food supply. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman issued a statement saying that the Canadian case appears to be an isolated one and poses little threat to other cattle or humans. Nevertheless, Veneman has ordered a ban on the import of Canadian cattle and cattle products pending further investigation. While this may be the first case of mad cow disease in a cow born in North America, the disease continues to affect other countries. France, Ireland, and Spain have each reported more than 36 cases of mad cow disease already this year. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 2 points to close at 8,491 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost a point. It closed at 1,491. This is NPR News. The United States, Britain, and Germany say they're temporarily closing their embassies and consulates in Saudi Arabia because of concerns about possible terrorist attacks. Meanwhile, Saudi officials say they've arrested 3 more suspected members of Al-Qaeda. Those arrests and 4 others that were announced earlier followed the suicide bombings last week in Riyadh. Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols has entered a not guilty plea to 162 counts of state murder charges. Heather Spencer reports from member station KGOU.
District Judge Stephen Taylor entered a not guilty plea on behalf of Nichols. Nichols sat quietly during his arraignment in a makeshift courtroom in the basement of the Oklahoma County Jail. He is already serving life in prison on federal convictions for his role in the 1995 bombing. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in the state's case against him. Last week, testimony by star witness Michael Fortier implicated Nichols in the bombing and matched statements made in the federal trials of Nichols and bomber Timothy McVeigh. Fortier is serving a 12-year sentence for never telling anyone about the bombing plot. The state charges include victims who were not part of the federal case and two fetuses whose mothers died in the bombing. For NPR News, I'm Heather Spencer in Norman, Oklahoma.
A federal judge in Texas is refusing to release truck driver Tyrone Williams on bond. Williams is being held in connection with the deaths of 19 illegal immigrants who died after being crammed into a hot, unventilated truck with dozens of other people. Three other suspects have also been arrested. At a bond hearing today, an FBI agent said it wasn't the first time Williams had used his truck for smuggling immigrants. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Tim and Maylie Krauskopf, for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like the museums, schools, and banks of Iraq, many of the hospitals have been looted. My guest, Dr. Lynn Amowitz, has just returned from Iraq, where she was assessing conditions in hospitals. She also observed the chaos at mass graves that were just uncovered. Dr. Amowitz is senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights, a group of healthcare professionals dedicated to the investigation and prevention of violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. She's a specialist in internal medicine, women's health, and epidemiology. Her work with Physicians for Human Rights has also taken her to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. From late March until the end of last week, Dr. Amowitz traveled through the Iraqi cities of Nasiriyah, Umm Qasr, Najaf, Karbala, Hilla, and Baghdad. I asked her if hospital conditions were similar in the cities and villages she visited.
Conditions are not similar in Iraq. It depends on where you are. If you're in the north, it's very different from the south or even from central or Baghdad area. Remember that the previous regime favored Baghdad, and the Tikrit area did not favor the Shia areas and certainly didn't favor the Kurd areas. So much of the resources went to the central areas and into Baghdad. Hospitals in the south were dilapidated in many cases, unclean, did not have electricity, did not have water, did not have supplies, where initially some hospitals in Baghdad had a 3-month supply of drugs or had equipment. You can find MRIs in Baghdad. You cannot find MRIs in the south.
So Baghdad had MRIs, but in the south there were none.
No, there were none. And you were lucky if you could find an operating X-ray machine in the south or in the Shia areas.
Well, forget high tech. I mean, you've reported that doctors were reusing scalpels and using catheters and IVs for periods far longer than they're intended to be used. And that can result in terrible infections.
This is always the case, and, you know, whenever you're in a situation where supplies are short, you're always going to see things that are not supposed to be used more than once, to be reused. It was particularly bad for the maternity hospitals, where supplies for the maternity hospitals in particular had not been happening to the same level that they had been happening for other hospitals. And so you were seeing women having to use a urinary catheter for more than a month, or they were reusing scalpels and all kinds of other equipment.
What else did you see at the obstetric units?
The obstetric units were a completely separate case, and this was somewhat of a surprise to us because we had heard before we went in that the hospitals were sort of uniformly not well supplied or had supplies for 3 months but maybe didn't have some specific drugs. When we went into Nasiriyah, we went to visit the maternity and child hospital that was in Nasiriyah. We found, actually, in discussions with the female OBGYNs, that in fact they had not had drugs that were specific for women for the last 5 years. They had no anesthetic, and they were doing the episiotomies, which is to cut the skin so that the baby can come out easier without any type of anesthesia whatsoever, when the other hospitals had anesthesia not more than a 5-minute drive away.
Are there many women dying in childbirth now because of the bad sanitation and lack of electricity?
Maternal mortality, or women dying in and around childbirth, is relatively high in Iraq. The number quoted by UNICEF is 294 women die for every 100,000 live births. If you look at that number compared to Afghanistan, where it was 1,600 per 100,000, it doesn't sound like a huge number. But if you compare it to the U.S., which is 8 per 100,000, and you look at the Iraqi medical system, you have to wonder why it should be so high. And there are many reasons that women die in childbirth. They are usually because of lack of hospitals that can care for women that have complications in pregnancy. And we saw quite a bit of this in several of the hospitals in the areas that we were in. In addition, over the last 10 years, there's been more than a doubling of infant mortality cases and children dying under the age of 5. So the Iraqi healthcare system has certainly declined over the last 10 years and will probably continue to do so unless this is paid attention to.
No, it sounds like the problems that you were seeing at the hospitals in Iraq were from a combination of things. Some of the problems were just because of sanctions. Some of the problems were because Saddam Hussein was totally unfair in how he allocated funding for hospitals. Some of the problems were because of the bombing. Some of the problems were post-war problems because of the looting and the anarchy. Am I being accurate in saying that?
I think that's completely accurate. I think it is multifactorial.
But what held it all together is that all the hospitals you went to were in terrible shape.
It's hard to say that they were in terrible shape. They were not in a shape that you would want to get care in. I think one of the most surprising things is that you forget how necessary it is to have water and what a simple loss of water can do to a hospital. There's nothing to clean with. There's no water to clean hands. There's no water to clean instruments. So the hospitals were filthy, and you were spending most of your time batting away flies and trying to listen to the needs of the doctors and the nurses and the hospital staff. And you were just amazed at how many flies could gather in one place.
Now, the lack of water, was that because of the bombing of infrastructure?
Part of the lack of water was bombing of infrastructure. Part of it was some of the holdouts from Saddam's regime that went and purposely cut water lines and cut water mains. There was another problem that we discovered, which was not expected, was that as the water supplies and the pumping stations lost electricity and weren't able to pump water to houses, people started digging down into the water mains. And we saw this in Nasiriyah, that they would dig down to the water main, punch holes in the water main, put hoses in, and then siphon off the water into these houses. Now, what that does is make a closed system now open. And so even if you're able to get the water pumping again, you're going to have a completely contaminated system. And then you have to go around and really start plugging all these holes that are being put in the water main system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz. She's a senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. And she was in Iraq from the end of March through just a few days ago. Some of the medical aid to Iraq has come in the form of donated field hospitals. What are those field hospitals?
The field hospitals in Iraq were given by governments around the world. I think the intention was that these would substitute, and definitely these political governments thought that these would substitute for care in Iraq. The problem is that they set up a parallel system of care. Iraq is not one of those places that had no health care system. You have a community of physicians that prior to the 1980s were all subspecialty trained in the West and were highly trained and technical. One of the things that we saw as we were going through the hospitals was a very elaborate echocardiogram reports and catheterization reports from highly trained physicians. So for a government to send in a field hospital that's supposed to substitute for what's already there was not the best way of handling any type of aid or care to the hospitals. It would have been far better to figure out what was needs-based, go to the hospital, find out what's missing and supply that, as opposed to taking a very expensive field hospital, bringing it in and not using the Iraqi health professionals that are already there. Parallel systems only create an expectation of the Iraqi civilians that it's better care. They see it as these big fancy tents and lots of doctors who are not Iraqi, and they feel that that's better. And it really changes the relationship between the doctors and the patients within Iraq.
Now, you mentioned that the obstetrics units were having a lot of problems. Were there other problems that you found in your tour of Iraqi hospitals that seemed unique to women?
I think one of the things that is probably unique to women in Iraq is that we don't know anything about their needs or their desires. They have not had a voice for years. And similar to Afghanistan, there is a lot of assumptions that are made about them and about what they need. For one interesting thing that we found was that the Ministry of Health, which was a male-dominated Ministry of Health, had made rules and regulations about who could and could not get birth control. And when you ask the female physicians or the OBGYNs about this, they were very adamant that those rules needed to go as the regime went and as there were new rules made within the Ministry of Health. They also felt that birth control should be free and that it should be supplied, because apparently over the last 5 years in many of the hospitals, it was very difficult to get birth control and any type of medicine that was specific for women.
Gee, what was the Iraqi government's criteria for deciding which women get birth control and what kind they get?
They had this very elaborate system of deciding how many children you had, whether you had medical problems or not, whether it would be a danger to you to have more children. But the decisions were always made by someone else, not by the patient or the patient and her husband alone.
Did you find that there were any fears within the Iraqi medical community about Islamic fundamentalists gaining more control in the country and how that might affect health care?
There was a concern as we were starting to wind down our activities over the last couple of weeks. A lot of the clerics, the Islamic fundamentalists, were taking over many of the clinics and hospitals, including taking over hospitals with force. We had reports in Baghdad of several hospitals being taken over with AK-47s. The concern that we had was that this type of takeover, and what the clerics were doing was saying, well, you know, we're filling the gap. We're going to pay the salaries of the doctors. We're going to give you security. We have lots of money. We're going to give you the supplies that you need. So the hospitals and the hospital administrators were thankful for all of these things. But it was also somewhat clear that there was a little bit of fear of what would happen once that gap was filled. And we had a concern that we still have not been able to substantiate very well, that women's health care would suffer under another Islamic fundamentalist regime, that we've seen this in Afghanistan, that when you have this type of fundamentalism, that women are usually the ones who suffer the most, and that they could possibly make policies within clinics that would affect women, such as women cannot be examined by men no matter what, or women cannot get birth control, or there are certain drugs that cannot be given to women. And I think only time will tell and further investigation, but this is a great concern.
My guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz, senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz, senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. She just returned from Iraq, where she was assessing conditions in hospitals. Now, in addition to touring the hospitals of Iraq, you also visited the sites of mass graves. What did you see? Like, which graves did you visit, and what did you see?
Some of the graves I will not talk about, only because we're trying to protect some of those from being identified. Some of the ones that I did see were between Karbala and Najaf and have already been dug up, mainly by bulldozers and by family members, you know, deeply searching for their loved ones. But what you find when you go to these areas are just piles of bones and clothing and shoes. And one of the more surprising things to me was to see so many female skeletons, you know, skeletons that clearly had longer hair or were still had the black headscarf around their head. And you find things like bullet holes in the heads. You would see wrists that were still tied together with this nylon rope. And it wouldn't just be one pair of wrists. It would be many pairs of wrists.
Now, I know a lot of people were going through the mass graves, trying to see if they could find evidence of loved ones they had who had disappeared. How are they doing that? Because unless you find an article of clothing, I mean, you can't identify bones without scientific, that's like scientific lab work. You can't just like find bones and figure out whether that's your husband or your son or your daughter.
You're exactly right. And what happens when family members start looking for their loved ones, if it's not the first body they come across, they sort of just pass those bones off to the side. Unfortunately, there were lots of victims that were buried in their clothes. And at that time, particularly in the early 90s, you had to carry an identification card in the pocket. And so many of the skeletons were found with an identification card in the pocket. And if that family was somehow lucky, they were able to find out if that was their loved one. If it wasn't their loved one, they just sort of pushed it aside, or a bulldozer came and pushed it aside. And then that card is now separated from the skeleton, and everything is blowing in the wind. So it does leave a huge problem for those who want to find their loved ones. And in some cases, I think that they were probably just taking bones, wrapping them in the shrouds that are so traditional for the Shia, and taking them for burial because of this need to have something, to have a family member back.
What is usually done at the site of a mass grave to protect against this kind of chaos?
Protection of mass grave sites has to have U.S. troops. At this point, the U.S. has not done this, and you have to have some type of security. But at the same time that you're securing the site, you also need to say why you're securing the site. You need to talk with local leaders. You need to educate the community as to what the process will be and why it's important, and to reassure them that, you know, the bones are not the property of anybody but the families, and they will be theirs. However, there has to be an orderly process to do it so that it's fair to everybody.
One of the things that I believe you investigated was whether doctors were asked to participate in torture sessions. And this has been a problem for many years, where there are doctors who are kind of pressed into doing this, pressed by the state. Did you find this in Iraq?
We did find this in Iraq. In Basra and Nasiriyah and in Najaf, we found physicians who were willing to tell us that they had been threatened by the previous regime into doing things that they would not normally have done, such as one of the problems with not wanting to be in Saddam's army was that if you refused, and remember, most of his army was forced conscripted or forced to fight. And if you somehow refused, the penalty was to have your right ear cut off. What the regime would do is that they would bring these deserters or these young men who refused to enter the army to the surgeons in a hospital, and they would then threaten the doctors and tell them that they had to cut off the right ear.
And what was the penalty if the doctor refused?
The doctor refused. We heard reports of them being threatened to be killed, or the family would be threatened to be killed or even tortured. In other cases, we also heard that many of them simply heard that the, quote, security persons were coming with these young men, and they would take emergency leave and go away for a month and hope that some other doctor was forced to do this. In that way, they would get out of it. It was a survival technique that they tried to employ to get out of having to do something like this.
Now, how did you find out about this?
We actually asked the doctors directly what had happened over the last few years and what had they been forced to do that they didn't want to do. And in a flood of conversation in one hospital in particular, we had four older physicians that had been working in a hospital in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and they basically said to us, you know what, we've had this on our mind forever. We need to get it off our chest. Here's what happened.
And what else did you hear besides cutting off of ears and punishment for young men who didn't join the army?
Physicians were also asked to administer the mercy bullets in people that were being tortured, victims that were tortured by the regime. If the torture didn't kill them, they were brought to the hospital or a doctor was brought to the torture chamber, which was not usually that far from the hospital. It was usually the police station or some other security building close to one of the hospitals. And they were asked to administer the mercy bullet to kill the patient. Or they may have been asked to say whether the torture victim was dead or alive. If the doctor had said that he was alive when he was really dead, the consequences were swift for the doctor as well. Or if he pronounced him dead when he was really alive, then the doctor would also be in trouble. So this was a dilemma for the doctors. And when we asked the doctors what they did in a case where it was a no-win situation for them, one of the doctors sort of looked at the floor, shuffled his feet, and said, I don't remember what I did.
Why would you need a doctor to deliver the mercy bullet? I mean, couldn't any old torturer just shoot somebody in the head and kill them?
Of course they could, but this was, you know, techniques were to intimidate, to make sure that leaders within the community were afraid and would do whatever they were told by anybody. It was a very oppressive regime.
Are there a couple of other countries that you can mention in which doctors have been forced to participate in state-sponsored torture?
I think there are 60 countries around the world that use torture. That is state-sponsored, and many of those physicians are asked to be complicit. Pakistan has been noted in that, Kosovo in the recent years. Turkey is another one.
Dr. Lynn Amowitz is senior medical researcher for Physicians for Human Rights. She traveled through Iraq in April and the first half of May. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Jan Yema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, visiting Uncle Andy Warhol. We talk with artist James Warhola about his new children's book, which describes a 1962 visit to his uncle's home. Also, the early days of the Velvet Underground when it was managed by Warhol.
I'm waiting for my man. 26 dollars in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Imagine how surprised Andy Warhol must have been when his brother, sister-in-law, and their 7 kids paid one of their surprise visits to his Manhattan home and moved in for a few days. My guest, James Warhola, was one of those 7 kids. He loved those visits to Uncle Andy's house, and now he's written and illustrated a book called Uncle Andy's A Fabulous Visit with Andy Warhol. It's in the form of a children's book, but it's probably even more interesting to adults. Warhola is a children's book illustrator who has also done the cover art for many paperbacks and has drawn for Mad Magazine. James Warhola's father, Paul, was Andy Warhol's oldest brother. The Warhola family lived in the countryside outside Pittsburgh, where Paul owned a junkyard. The new book is set in 1962, the year that Andy Warhol made his first soup cans. James was about 7. Warhola says his uncle's house was like a giant amusement park filled with art and found objects like carousel horses.
When we would first come into the house, we'd go up a few steps, and there was this giant crumpled piece of metal, and it was a John Chamberlain sculpture of a wrecked car. And it was kind of stuck in the hallway, and you'd always have to make a right into a smaller room, which was his studio. And that was always a centerpiece we'd kind of look at, and he was always so proud of that piece. He'd always say it was by a famous artist, and we'd kind of look at it and seem to, like, question it, you know, what was it? And he'd say it was a part of a car, and of course, we always saw a lot of that back home at my dad's junkyard. But throughout the house, he would have, he had a lot of early, I guess you'd call them advertising objects, such as large Coke bottles and Pepsi Cola signs, and they would be intermixed throughout the house. And I think he thought all that was art in some way, and he started collecting that all through the 50s.
Now, you said that that your Uncle Andy's house and some of the art in it reminded you of your father's junkyard. Your father ran a junkyard, and it's just such an interesting comparison between the kind of pop art and found art that Andy Warhol was interested in, the kind of junk that your father collected and sold. You want to make that comparison a little more for us?
Oh, yeah. For one thing, it's hard to believe that my dad, who is his older brother, came from the same family, and we lived a life in Pittsburgh in the countryside of western Pennsylvania, not far out of Pittsburgh, and my dad ran a junk business, and there were 7 in our family, and the boys were expected to kind of help out in the junkyard, and we knew the junk business pretty well, so every once in a while, my father would announce these visits that it was time to go visit Uncle Andy and Bubba in the big city, and Bubba being my grandmother, and he'd always take things from the junkyard when we'd go up to these on these trips. He'd take things that he thought that my uncle would appreciate, because my dad he was almost a frustrated artist in his own right, and. He had a good eye for things, and in fact, early on, he was always bringing objects home for me to kind of make art out of, and I was a bit of more of a traditionalist in certain ways, and I couldn't see it the same way as my father. But anyway, my dad, he'd bring this stuff home from the junkyard, and he would kind of do different types of sculpture, and when he had the time, he would fool around, but in general, he had to just make a living and support our family.
So what kind of objects would your father take from his junkyard to bring as gifts for Andy?
Oh, well, if it wasn't crumpled up metal, the one object I remember and I show in the book was this giant magnet that had this mass of bolts and screws attached to it, and it was kind of like you could sculpt the mass of bolts into different shapes, and he brought that up, and my uncle was quite impressed and put that near the doorway, and there was many other odds and ends, even like old arcade like vending machines and things that he thought that Andy would appreciate, and my uncle he was always He was always impressed. I mean, he saw something interesting in everything. So it wasn't too hard to make him happy with some object that we would bring up.
What great eyes to be able to see out of. Do you know what I mean? To, like, see things through your uncle's eyes, who found so many discardable objects really fascinating and beautiful and important.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wondered how, you know, he got that. I always attribute it to my grandmother, who he lived with for some 20 years. She had an interesting kind of artistic sense. And, of course, she was quite an important foundation for him, living there in New York with him.
Yeah, and you know what? It's so hard to think of Andy Warhol living with his mom. You know, you think of Andy Warhol as, like, this kind of detached, cool, you know, hip artist surrounded by, you know, gender-bending artists who are high on drugs and creating this really, you know, nearly perverse scene. You don't think of him as living with his mom.
I know. Quite. That's been the usual perception. Most people are quite surprised that he had his mother there, and she took care of him. And I think he was a lot of his success he owes to his mother. And of course, having two brothers with, each of them having a lot of kids was another aspect that people didn't realize. And it's quite an interesting contrast that in a lot of quite a surprise to a lot of people.
How long did he live with his mother?
It was probably from the early 50s to 1970, so it was almost 20 years.
So even after he was famous, he was living with her.
Oh yeah. He didn't have too many people come to his house. So that, I think that's you know, the reason maybe people didn't realize.
So the scene was at the factory, but that was separate from his house.
Yeah, definitely. The factory scene was, it came about, I think, his first studio was an old firehouse, and that was in 1963. And then a year or two later, he got a place in Midtown, and that, I think, that's when the word the factory got coined. And that's where all those stories come of the wild going-ons. And most of the time up on 89th and Lex, he was always hard at work. There wasn't really, if anything, they protected us from the city itself. We were kind of isolated there.
My guest is James Warhola. He wrote and illustrated the new book, Uncle Andy's, A Fabulous Visit with Andy Warhol. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is artist and children's book illustrator and author James Warhola. His new book is called Uncle Andy's, A Fabulous Visit with Andy Warhol. And it's a children's book about his visit to his uncle Andy Warhol's place when he was a child. Now, your father ran a junkyard. The junkyard was about a mile away on a dirt road from your actual home. But judging from the illustrations in the book, the lawn of your home was filled with junk.
Oh, yes.
Describe what your lawn typically looked like.
Well, it always had a few junk cars. I think when my dad found it convenient, instead of taking some truckloads of things up to the junkyard, he would just dump them off at the house. And it was quite a sight at times. And you know, with seven kids having a busy family, it was a sight with all kinds of objects strewn about. Occasionally we'd clean things up, and then slowly but surely it would get back to quite a mess. And it was an old shingled, ramshackled house before we got it sided and made it a little bit more presentable. But It was the illustration I did of that that scene is pretty true.
Let me ask you to describe one of the illustrations in your book that is among my favorite. And this is the illustration of one of your siblings walking into Andy Warhol's bedroom.
Yes, that's my little sister, Maddie, and we kind of put her up to it. Usually, my uncle, he would go out late at night. He'd come back very late, and he'd sleep in during the morning till around 10. And when the door would crack open, it was time that he could have visitors, and we'd be waiting on the steps anxiously, wondering who he had seen that was famous, and he'd love telling us. And I think during that specific time, we told our little sister Maddie that it was that Andy was ready. Our uncle was ready to have guests, and she went in ahead of us. And of course, he didn't have his wig on yet, and it was there was a bit of a shriek, and he grabbed I think a handkerchief to throw on his head for that moment. But it was quite funny, and I was able to work it into the story. I don't think any of my other siblings have seen him without his wig. I think it was my sister Maddie was the lucky one there.
It's a great picture. So there's a picture of your sister shrieking because she realizes she's shocked Andy. And Andy has his hands over his head, and he's kind of screaming because he's so surprised and embarrassed. His wig is flying through the air. He's jumping in surprise so that there's magazines falling off the bed, his tape recorder, his little cassette recorder is falling off the bed. The cats are falling off the bed. There's cats all over this picture. There's a couple of cats falling off the bed. There's cats underneath the bed. There's cats in the canopy over the bed. There's cats under the night table. There's cats on the rug.
Yeah, the cats actually, he had a lot of Siamese cats going in through the house. I think they were friendly to him and my grandmother, but they were very mysterious animals. They hid a lot. So we didn't get to see him very much, but they were always around.
You say he had wigs for every occasion, and then when he was done with wigs, he'd give them to your family. And then there's another picture of everyone in your family wearing an Andy Warhol wig. It's a great picture.
Yeah, as of course my father was bald, and he thought my dad would, you know, be able to use his old wigs. And of course we brought boxes of wigs back to Pittsburgh, but little did my uncle know that we kind of masqueraded through the house with these wigs. And my dad, of course, he didn't use them that much except to entertain people when we'd have guests. So it was, I don't think my uncle would have appreciated that.
There's a great picture of you sleeping at your Uncle Andy's townhouse. And you're in a room sleeping, you know, on this cot, and you're surrounded by cartons, rows and rows of cartons piled up to the ceiling of Campbell's soup cans. And tell us about this illustration.
On the top floor, he had this room where he had nothing but soup boxes, and they were stacked like skyscrapers. And I remember on one of those visits, he bring us to the rooms and at night, and we wouldn't know quite what was in it, but in the morning we'd wake up and there would be these huge columns of these soup boxes. And of course they weren't just cardboard boxes, they were made out of wood and silk screened very carefully, and it was quite a sight. I mean, we always questioned like what it was, and but we knew it was important. He always told us not to touch them, and it was certainly a sight, and then especially when you'd have to sleep amongst them.
Your family used to own one of Warhol's soup cans. How did you end up owning it, and how come you no longer own it?
Well, early on, in late 61, my dad was in New York, and I think it was just at the very beginning when my uncle was coming up with the idea of the soup can, and he gave my dad a small 16x20 can that was hand-painted, and my father brought it home, and we were just, we cherished it for many years, of course. It was important to us. He didn't give us too many things, a few things, a few small things, but that was one of our prized possessions. And we jointly owned it for all these years, and it just got to be kind of impractical to kind of keep it. And I think last year, We all decided that it was probably the best time to try to sell it, and we did sell it and sold it Christie's for a little over $1 million, which was quite an amazing amount to all of us, considering we took it to school endlessly on the bus in a brown paper bag, showed it to our teachers, our classmates. Each of us had a turn with it, and it was always in the family. It was tough to see it go, but it was the only way of sharing it. And at this point in time, when most of us, most of my siblings are in their 40s and 50s and 60s.
You said it became impractical to keep it.
Yeah, I think occasionally one of us would have it for a few years, and then it would get passed on to another family member. I mean, we kind of shared it. So I think it was hard to keep as a family heirloom.
What kind of reactions from people do you get when they see that your name was Warhola? Do they guess that you're a relative of Andy Warhol's? And then, if so, what kind of questions do you get asked?
Well, I guess it's only since he passed away that most people make the connection, but most people never made the connection that his name was Warhola. So when, nowadays, most people do make the connection, and I guess sometimes they think that maybe we inherited a lot of paintings and maybe we're very wealthy, but I sometimes have to tell them that it's not quite that way. Most of his paintings were left to a giant foundation, and it's a foundation for the arts, and it's quite an important foundation, and it does a lot of good for institutions and artists. So I usually tell them that, and then quite often they want to know if I ever met him, and how I knew him, and if I met any famous people. And occasionally I say, yeah, I occasionally did, and it was quite a lot of fun.
Does your family feel cheated at all that he didn't leave more to the family?
Well, I think there's always been a little question there. I mean, it would have been his will was, of course, very concise and very brief. I don't think he ever expected to die as suddenly as he did. He died from a bad gallbladder back in '87. So, even though he had premonitions that if he went into a hospital that he wouldn't come out, he just wasn't prepared for it. So I think he may have, if he had lived longer, he may have thought it through and been a little more considerate, I think, to the family.
Are you preparing another book?
I have a few ideas. I might. It's either going to be a book about race cars or a runaway pig. I'm not quite sure what it's going to be. Ultimately, I would love to do another book about my growing up. I think that my grandmother, I couldn't show her fully in this book because it was limited to 32 pages, and actually she would have just taken over because she was such a character. She was a very magical character in our family, and I think that if I was to do another book, I'd probably want to highlight her more.
Well, James Warhola, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
James Warhola wrote and illustrated the new book, Uncle Andy's, A Fabulous Visit with Andy Warhol. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the early days of the Velvet Underground, when the band was managed by Andy Warhol. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
James Warhol's book about his uncle Andy Warhol is set in 1962. 3 years later, the Velvet Underground started recording. In its early days, the band was managed by Andy Warhol. The Velvet Underground never made the charts, but today they're recognized as one of the most important bands in rock history. After the release of a box set collecting the Velvet's recordings from 1965 to 70, our rock historian Ed Ward looked back on the Velvet's first recordings.
I'm waiting for the man 26 dollars in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for the man.
Things didn't look good for American rock and roll in 1965. The Brits were running riot over our charts, and while Retaliation was in the works, it seemed like it would be a long time before we came up with anything half as innovative or important as the Beatles or the Rolling Stones were doing. Actually, though, something did happen, something that was ignored at the time, the Velvet Underground. The Velvet Underground was the result of a unique group of talents getting together. Lewis Allen Reed, a troubled Long Island teenager who'd recorded while still in high school and then attended Syracuse University to study literature, Sterling Morrison, who was attending classes there but never registered, and John Cale, who met Reed while they were both working at a schlock rock label, recording Hot Rod novelty records in the year after Reed's graduation. Reed and Morrison had the literary background, Cale the avant-garde musical chops. He'd come from his native Wales on a Leonard Bernstein scholarship and was performing with Lamont Young, father of today's avant-garde, and hacking out rock novelties to pay the bills. The three started jamming at Cale's downtown New York loft, and the results sounded like Simon and Garfunkel, until the lyrics kicked in.
Shiny, shiny boots of leather. Whiplash, girl child in the dark. Comes in bells, your servant, don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, cure his heart.
They added Maureen Tucker, sister of Morrison's college roommate, on drums after their first drummer proved too weird and started calling themselves the Velvet Underground after a book on suburban sadomasochism they'd found in the street. Journalist Al Aronowitz got them a steady gig at Café Bizarre. They were fired before too long, but not before attracting the attention of Andy Warhol, who needed a band for a multimedia spectacular he was planning, and early in 1966, he produced their first album. Those songs from Cale's loft were transformed.
Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather. Whiplash, girl child in the dark. Forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart.
Cale's electric viola, the droning guitars, not to mention the subject matter, this was something new. But Warhol insisted that the four weren't glamorous enough, and he added a singer, Christa Päfgen, a German model who'd been doing some recording in London and used the name Nico. She added another dimension to the sound.
Identical to Reed's, and yes, she was glamorous, in a chilly sort of way.
Having Warhol's art cachet freed the band to experiment sonically, too, and here Cale's genius kicked in. The notorious noise blowout, starting with an electrified metal chair being scraped across the floor in European sun, was definitely aimed at the New York art crowd.
Shiny,
they'd released their first album while they were still riding high on their success in Warhol's Plastic Exploding Inevitable show, they might have achieved some notoriety. But things dragged on, and it didn't appear until early 1967, at which point Peace and Love didn't want to know about those boots of shiny, shiny leather. Undaunted, the band went back into the studio in September to make a second record, without Nico, and with their avant-garde tendencies in full cry. White Light, White Heat was a truly inspired failure. Some of it was virtually unlistenable more than once, like Cale's reading an undergraduate short story of Reed's on The Gift. And then there was Sister Ray, 17 minutes of ghastly noise that sort of grew on you if you could stay the course. Distorted almost to the point of pain, with perverse lyrics, this music opposed nearly everything the new era seemed to stand for. The album vanished almost without a trace. Warhol was out of the picture, and tension between Cale and Reed was reaching a high point. Who would have thought they stood on the verge of making one of the greatest albums of all time?
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The great album he just referred to is called The Velvet Underground. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Henry Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, I'm beginning to see the light. Want to tell all you people now. Now, now, baby, I'm beginning to see the light. Hey, now, baby, I'm beginning to see the light.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, filmmaker Guy Maddin talks about his new Dracula, a silent film version of the Bram Stoker classic danced by the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. A New York Times review described it as voluptuous, whimsical, and exceedingly strange. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.